The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
The arms crisis of 1970 left a cloud of suspicion hanging over Charlie Haughey for the remainder of his political career. Found not guilty of a conspiracy to smuggle arms to the Irish Republican Army in the north, Haughey and the other alleged co-conspirators suffered irreparable damage to their reputations. 10 years of research eventually brought my next guest to the facts of what actually happened in the lead up to the trial, and he lays them out in a new book which is called Deception and Lies. David Burke, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
Now, David, you actually say that this is a simple story which gets clouded up by the trial and all that followed. What is the simple narrative here for listeners who possibly weren't born when this all happened?
The simple story, I suppose, it begins with the eruption of the Troubles at the end of the 1960s. There was a intercommunal violence in August of 1969. On a very, very large scale, there was a lot of displacement of nationalists, Catholics in Belfast and elsewhere. There was the Battle of the Bogside. There was a huge influx of people, refugees, were coming across the border. And the Irish government was in a predicament because there was no realistic possibility that it could send troops across the border to help preserve the peace, restore the peace. And instead, the British Army came in, and the British Army went through what we often read about in the history books as the so-called honeymoon period, and that was quite successful. But there was an awful lot of pressure still on the Irish government to do something, and there was a great fear that if the British troops were to leave again, and there was talk even in Britain that the troops were only going to be there as a temporary stopgap measure, that was the initial hope, that if the troops left, there could be an outbreak of violence again. So covert plans were put in place by the Irish government to deal with these. And that's the real origin of the arms crisis.
Let's just talk about what the British government felt at the time. I mean, had they known that 30 years of so-called troubles lay ahead, they may have behaved differently. But they needed the trouble in the north as much as they needed a hole in the head. Mm. They didn't want this either.
Harold Wilson was Prime Minister and James Callaghan was Home Secretary. And their approach was to try and, first of all, restore peace, which they did to a large extent by the deployment of the troops. Then they started addressing some of the civil rights issues which had been at the political forefront in Northern Ireland. The context of this is very important. At the time, the IRA was quiescent. It was led by a man called Cathal Goulding, who had become a Marxist, and he wasn't interested in physical force violence, nor were many of the people around him. Now, there were other factions within the IRA, led by Sean McStiffon and people like that, who were, and a lot of the trouble would later on erupt. But as I say, it is a very, very simple story. And the first reaction of the Irish government was to vote £100,000 for the relief of distress. And some of that money got siphoned off to purchase arms. Now, the key thing here is the people who were going to try to purchase these arms, they were not the IRA. They were the Citizens Defence Associations, the CDCs. And they were led by people who later on emerged as SDLP ministers. They were led by priests. They were definitely not a front for the IRA.
They wanted to defend their communities. So this is the equivalent of having the pike in the thatch. They wanted to have some way in which they could deter a pogrom by loyalist crowds and mobs.
Exactly. And that's the key difference between them and the IRA. The IRA wanted to end partition. They wanted to, if you like, have a tilt at the crown, whereas the Citizens Defence Committees, who were in contact with the Irish government of Fianna Fáil at the time, they were only interested in stopping their houses being burnt, stopping rioting in their communities.
Now, the question of a covert siphoning of money to them to purchase arms rather than simply the money that would go to kind of refugees, if you like, to use a modern term, that was done quietly because they didn't want to annoy the British government, I suppose. But you would suggest, I think, that the British government probably knew all about this anyway. They had their spies.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about that. One of the first attempts by the Citizens Defence Committees to acquire arms took place in London. And John Kelly, who later became an arms trial defendant, went over with others, and they were followed all around London by men who were talking into radios, people who were talking up their sleeves, and it was a little, I describe it as more like Monty Python than Smiley's People, and they hightailed it back to Dublin very quickly, but they lured the British spy who was masquerading as an arms dealer, a guy called Captain Peter Markham Randall, to Dublin, and some of the hotheads actually decided that they were going to try and assassinate him. And fortunately for him and for Anglo-Irish relations, Captain James Kelly of Irish Military Intelligence, who was observing what was going on, was able to step in and intervene and stop that attempt going ahead. I mean, if that attempt had gone ahead, it would have been an absolute disaster.
Now, the subject of the arms trial was the attempted importation of arms using state funds and allegedly without the knowledge of the Taoiseach. So talk us through what you know now to have happened and who actually did know about this attempt.
Well, I could take you back briefly to September of 1969 when a flight did come in successfully from London with arms, and Kevin Boland, who was a minister in Jack Lynch's cabinet at the time, has written about this in one of his many books, and he says that practically everybody knew, or he believed everybody knew, about this flight coming in. Those arms were successfully brought through Dublin Airport. This is very much a forgotten incident. They were delivered to Cathal Goulding, the man I mentioned earlier, who was not interested in physical force violence, and those guns were not transported to the north. That was September, and then in November we had the fiasco in London. In December there was another fiasco in America where the Citizens Defence Committees nearly secured a pipeline, but that fell apart because Neil Blaney intervened for various reasons. So at the end of 1969, and we're now into January 1970, the Citizens Defence Committee people went to Irish Military Intelligence, went to Captain Kelly, and they said, look, we're not getting anywhere. Will you take it over? And Captain Kelly said, I'll send that up the line. He did. And it's at that stage that James Gibbons, the Minister for Defence, comes in, and he took it over. Now, I have spoken to a friend of Jim Gibbons, who's still alive. He's a former Fianna Fáil TD, and he knew that this was going on at the time, and he knew that prior to 1970, Gibbons was telling Jack Lynch what was happening, but Jack Lynch wasn't giving him any indications. In other words, this was all deniable. Let the money be siphoned off from the £100,000. If the Citizens Defence Committee people are successful, well, then it's not... it's plausibly deniable. But now this was much more serious. This was the Irish Army were going to intervene and take over. And Jack Lynch said yes. Now, in the book, I'm not at all critical of Jack Lynch for having done this, because I think it ticked a large number of boxes for him. In the first instance, there was a lot of Irish government money floating around. This was now going to be spent on arms, and it was going to be reabsorbed. So there was going to be less money around. If the weapons, which, by the way, they never arrived, and the flight ultimately was cancelled, but if the weapons had arrived, they were going to be taken to a monastery in County Cavan, where they were going to be kept under lock and key by the Irish Army, and they were only going to be released in the event of a doomsday situation. And frankly, I don't think that was ever going to arise. The type of doomsday situation that people had feared a repeat of, namely what had happened in August of 1969, was not going to happen. So I think in Jack Lynch's mind, and this is only my speculation, he was solving the problem. He was, in other words, he was taking this off the agenda, packing it away. And if things had worked out well for him, I think the weapons would have come through. They probably would have been taken to the monastery for a year or two. They would have gathered dust. None of us would be any the wiser, and there would have been no arms crisis.
So that was what he had hoped would happen. Now, did he at any point have direct meetings with the Citizens Defence Committees?
Yes. Now, these issues are still controversial. There are Citizens Defence Committees who came to Dublin and they said that they met with the Taoiseach, they met with the ministers. They were given very, very positive signals. Jack Lynch denied that later on in the Dáil, and he painted a completely different picture, one that's completely at odds. But there is a document which has emerged, and you recall I said that the Irish Military Intelligence stepped in an effective way and took over this operation in January. Well, the following February, a document issued from the Department of Defence It was withheld from the arms trial, and it has since emerged from the National Archives. And it identifies, it states that the Taoiseach and other ministers have met delegations from the North. At these meetings, urgent demands were made for respirators, weapons and ammunition, the provision of which the government agreed. So there's documentary evidence that the Taoiseach knew about this coming from the National Archives.
Now, this is the background to everything. When you have Charles Haughey, Neil Blaney, Kevin Boland, a lesser remembered TD, Podge Brennan, a Wicklow TD, all of these people are suddenly caught up in the business of importing arms. And as we'll come to the trial in a few minutes' time, the question was who knew, not was there an attempt, because the agreement was, yes, we're going to import arms, but it was with the benediction of the highest office in the land, the Taoiseach.
There's a bit of a myth about that Haughey, when he gave his evidence at the arms trial, flatly denied any involvement. That's not actually what he said. What he said was there were contingency plans drawn up by the military and that he was aware that this involved rearming the military and bringing in weapons. And he was actually asked, although he denied that he knew what the content of the famous or infamous consignment that was about to come through Dublin Airport, in other words, the arms, he denied that he had actual knowledge of that. But what he did say was he had a shrewd idea that it involved arms. He had signed off on it because he was the Minister for Finance and he was signing certificates that would allow it pass through customs at Dublin Airport without being inspected. He said he had a shrewd idea. And when he was asked if he had known that arms were involved, would it have made any difference? He said it wouldn't have. So he certainly knew what was going on, and Mr. Blaine knew what was going on, and Mr. Gibbons, above all, he knew more, I think, than most, because he was the Minister for Defence and he had a very hands-on involvement in it. Indeed, in what is probably the most bizarre sequence in the arms trial, Minister Gibbons acknowledged, and this was his own evidence, he acknowledged that he had been at a meeting with Captain James Kelly, who was the man in the field, the man on the ground, if you like, and that he had explained to him that one of the earlier attempts to bring the weapons in by a boat had failed and that there were going to be further reports. Now, if Captain Kelly was a rogue officer, which he wasn't, if he was attempting to import arms for the IRA, which he wasn't, with money stolen from the Exchequer, etc., there's no way in the world he would have been saying these things to the minister. And a bigger question arose out of that evidence. Why was he indeed having a meeting with the Minister for Defence to discuss these matters? And of course the answer is because it was a perfectly legitimate military intelligence operation to bring weapons in that's been misportrayed ever since.
Okay, now let's presume that everyone who was relevant, including the Taoiseach all the way down, knew what was going on. How was the cover blown on this operation, leading to Jack Lynch kind of distancing himself from it and sacking his ministers and so on? What was the key to opening all of this up to the Dáil and therefore to the public?
The intervention of Sean McStiafán, who became Chief of Staff of the Provisional IRA when it was set up in 1970. He had been recruited in the early 1960s. One of the dates I have been given is 1961. He was recruited in Cork by a policeman who later became a Garda Commissioner, who handed him pretty much immediately over to Philip McMahon. Philip McMahon was a legend in the Special Branch. He was then the head of the Special Branch, and he took over McStiafán in Cork. But the problem was McStiafán was playing a very deceptive game with the police. He was never anything but loyal to the IRA and to his ambitions to start a physical force campaign.
He was telling them stuff, probably fairly irrelevant stuff. They had recruited him in 1961. There had been the 1950s IRA campaign. I remember they used to blow up statues and things like that. And they also did try to plant some bombs on the British territory on the island of Britain. So there was always an interest in terms of the security forces and the activities of the IRA. So this guy, Sean McStiafán, signs up as an informer, but he gives them crumbs, but builds up his good offices.
Absolutely. So by the time the Troubles has erupted, 1969, he's now in a pivotal position. He's built up the credibility with McMahon and others in the Special Branch. And he starts feeding them nonsense and lies. And I mean, well, if you look, we know an awful lot about what he said, even though none of the files have been released. We nonetheless know an awful lot from the Peter Berry diaries, which were published by McGill in 1980 by Vincent Brown. Peter Berry was the Secretary General to the Department of Justice, and he wrote in his diaries about information that was coming in from the IRA. My information is that the only informant that the Gardaí had on the IRA Army Council at that time who was providing with information was Max Steofan. And some of it, now we look back and it is palpable nonsense. One of the first things he told the police was that the cabinet, now remember the cabinet had people like Erskine Childers, Jack Lynch and Paddy Hillary on it, that a cabinet consisting of those people had entered into a deal with the IRA to allow the IRA wage a war in Northern Ireland. That's absolute nonsense. It did not happen. And we know this for a multiple of reasons, one of which is that the IRA did not want to wage a war against partition. Carl Goulding did not want to do that. I mentioned Carl Goulding earlier on. When arms arrived in September, he didn't ship them to the north. He wanted a political Marxist solution. Hands across the border to the working class Protestant.
So Sean McStephen was telling one arm of the state, the special branch, that the cabinet had a deal with the IRA that they would turn a blind eye to anything that went on north of the border, which was palpably untrue. Now, we're talking about a book, Deception and Lies, The Hidden History of the Arms Crisis 1970, with David Burke. We'll continue our conversation on News Talk after this.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
I'm talking to David Burke, the author of a new book, Deception and Lies, The Hidden History of the Arms Crisis 1970. So getting back to Sean McStephan, who ultimately became the head of the Provisional IRA, the chief of staff, what was the key thing that he fed and to whom about the importation plan for arms?
Well, he was, throughout 1969, before the IRA split, he was drip-feeding the police with more nonsense about Captain Kelly giving Cathal Goulding large sums of money, sums £5,000-£7,000, which was an enormous amount of money back then, none of which was true. And he was planning, he was aware that weapons were going to be brought in, and he was planning actually to seize the weapons. And the weapons, a consignment was going to was meant to have arrived in Dublin port on a ship called the Motor Vessel City of Dublin on the 25th of March 1970. And unbeknownst to his Garda handlers, he had sent a four-man unit, provisional IRA unit, down armed. Now, had that hijack attempt gone ahead, it would have been the very first IRA armed event of their campaign. But it didn't go ahead, because when Captain Kelly examined the hold of the boat, he found that there were no weapons on board at all. And there were people around Captain Kelly in the Citizens Defence Committees who were signalling back to Sean McStephan. I have a very, very strong suspicion as to who it was. But in any event, a signal was sent to the four-man unit and they didn't go ahead with the hijack. Now, there's a huge importance arising out of this. If, as has been claimed for decades, Captain Kelly and Haughey and the rest of them were bringing weapons in for the Provisional IRA, why on earth would Sean McStephan have had to send down an armed unit to hijack it? Well, the answer is simple. The weapons were coming in for the citizens' defence people to be stored in a monastery. They were not being brought in for the Provisional IRA.
Yeah. And Sean McStephan had eyes on those weapons. If he could have got a hold of them, it would have been the arming of what became the Provisional IRA. So no arms coming in on this particular ship at the MV City of Dublin. No attack, therefore, to seize the arms, because they weren't going to be there. So how did Sean McStephan then turn that to his advantage?
Well, there was a suspicion that tripwires had been pulled in the background in Europe by British intelligence, and that is how the weapons hadn't made it onto the boat. And I think McStephan at some stage must have had to sit down and think that I have this great status with the guards. I don't want to blow it. I didn't tell them about this consignment of arms coming in. I'm speculating now, but in his mind, I think he was probably saying to himself, well, that would have been worth it. Now, this, remember, was March. By April, the IRA, the Provisional IRA, now I'm talking about, had established their own pipeline. and it was a success, and they were bringing in weapons from America, and they were of a far superior calibre to the ones Captain Kelly was bringing in. So all of a sudden, MacStiffon did not need these weapons. He had an opportunity. He could have tried to hijack them, but hijacking something in Dublin port is a whole different kettle of fish to trying to hijack something out of Dublin airport, where you have customs officials, you have police, God knows what else might have been there at the time. There was a UVF campaign, I think, going on around about that time. A couple of bombs went off. So you may very well have even had the army out of Dublin airport. And I think he decided, look, this is not going to work out. I don't need these guns. And instead he decides to create mischief. There's still a question mark over precisely how, where and when he gave the tip-off. Des O'Malley in his book says there was a tip-off. So he let that cat out of the bag, which, by the way, is completely different to what Jack Lynch said in The Doyle. But Des O'Malley has said that there was a tip-off. My information is that there was a tip-off. I think they probably would have found out anyway the weapons were coming in, because it was such a mess out of Dublin airport, with people going out and certificates being questioned and descriptions of the consignment coming in as being mild steel. And they probably would have found out, but all hell broke loose then. Now, the guards, this is the key point, the guards were not aware what was going on, and the guards thought that these weapons were being brought in by a corrupt cabal of military intelligence officers acting to corrupt ministers with stolen money for the benefit of the IRA. And they went into panic and they locked down Dublin Airport. And Peter Berry organised that lockdown. He called it the Ring of Steel. And he did it behind his own minister's back, because at that stage he didn't trust the government. He didn't trust his minister. He didn't even trust Jack Lynch. That's why he famously went and spoke about these matters to President De Valera. And then later on he confronted... This was the weekend of the 17th, 18th, 19th of April, 1970. And on Monday, the 20th, he went and he confronted Jack Lynch about this. And Jack Lynch denied it. And that sparks the arms crisis.
Well, a key is that the then Taoiseach, Liam Cosgrave, was told by whomever. Mm. And he then, I think, allegedly contacted Jack Lynch and said, look, there is... something going on here. You are being subverted by your own ministers. You got to do something. Mm. And Jack Lynch then, faced with this knowledge being out there and potentially being announced to the Doyle, decided to take action, ask for the resignation of ministers, not forthcoming. He sacked them, basically.
Mm. His initial response when Peter Berry told him that this was happening was to go into cover-up mode. And there are at least three different accounts provided by the players as to what happened. And if you try to analyse them and find a common thread of truth, you're just wasting your time, because at this stage, everybody had started covering up. But what is absolutely clear is that the ministers were not fired initially. And this went on for quite a number of days. And I don't believe for one second they would have been fired. The whole thing would have been successfully covered up. But for the leaks... Now, something very important arises out of that. If Jack Lynch didn't know about the arms coming in, and if he was being told by the police and genuinely believed that some of his ministers were acting corruptly with stolen exchequer funds to bring in weapons for the IRA, and they were using corrupt and treacherous military intelligence officers to achieve this, he would not have left his ministers sitting around the cabinet table. So first of all, he tries to cover it up. And then the special branch leaked the information to Liam Cosgrave, leader of the opposition, leader Fine Gael, and there were also other various leaks in newspapers, and eventually got to the stage in the first week of May where Jack Lynch had no choice but to sack his ministers. And at this stage he'd backed himself into a corner. He had denied to Peter Berry and others any knowledge of the arms importation. He could hardly now come out and say, well, I wasn't being quite candid. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing then spiralled out of control.
Those accused, I mean, some of them never made it to trial. Neil Blaney was never put on formal trial for this. The others who were acquitted. And at that point, we'll talk about, how that came about in court. But Haughey called on Jack Lynch to consider his position after his acquittal.
Mm. There was at least one phone call between Charles Haughey and Jack Lynch, and I suspect there were many, many more. And Neither man ever spoke about what they discussed, ever. Both of them passed away without having enlightened us at all. But I think that Lynch and Haughey came to an agreement between themselves. Now, this is just my opinion, and I could be wrong, and you can challenge me on it. So I'll just put it forward as an opinion. And I think they had an agreement where Lynch effectively was saying to Charles Haughey, look, I have tried to cover it up. I know what you did was legitimate. You were not bringing in guns for the IRA with stolen money, etc. But someone has to take the rap for this, because we can't have a diplomatic breach with Northern Ireland, with Britain, and we don't want to kick over a hornet's nest with the loyalists in Northern Ireland and kick up the trouble again. So Haughey then bit the bullet. He was out of cabinet. And Jack Lynch, there was this famous 36-hour marathon debate in the Dáil. And Jack Lynch came into there and he said very complimentary things about Charles Haughey and about how he had a future in the party, which indeed he did, because he was brought back onto the front bench in 1975 and he was brought back into cabinet in 1977. Now, if, as Lynch has subsequently claimed, he believed that these guns were coming in for the IRA with stolen money, etc., I just don't believe he would have said those very...
So you think he made a devil's bargain with Haughey? You suck this up. There's got to be a scapegoat. We don't want to destroy diplomatic relations with Britain by, you know, me having to resign because I knew about this all along. That would be a horrendous situation for Ireland Inc. to find itself in. So you do this and you will be rehabilitated. And that was the deal. That's your belief.
That's my belief. Now, that was simply a dismissal or a resignation, whatever way you want to look at it, from cabinet. Haughey at that stage did not, I believe, fear that he was going to face trial. And one of the things I have dug up was conversation between Jack Lynch and the British ambassador, during which he refers to Charles Haughey as Charlie, and he says he hopes he's going to get off the charges. So there are a lot of indications, but they're buried, they're vague. Jack Lynch was a politician who was able to move around, leaving a very faint trail after him.
Now, finally, David, I mean, people can read the book, and I hope they do, because it's the level of detail in it and your references and so on. People can follow whatever trail they want to follow in deciding on what they believe. But ultimately, why did the acquittal happen? I mean, what were the key elements in the witness statements and so on in the trial that led to the acquittal?
Oh, I mean, the arms trial was an absolute shuddering disgrace. The behaviour of the prosecution was appalling. Evidence was withheld. Documents were forged. Statements were altered. But the jury, and oh, there was even an allegation, which is completely untrue, that the jury was intimidated. The jury effectively acquitted them within an hour, 50 minutes on one account. They simply listened to the evidence of a very fine colonel in military intelligence, Colonel Heffron. Colonel Heffron had been placed under pressure to commit perjury. On the morning of the first arms trial, he told the relevant parties he was not going to commit perjury. He was going to tell the truth. And when the jury listened to him at the second arms trial, that was decisive. And there was a lot of other evidence as well. I mentioned earlier on James Gibbons having said that he had this meeting with Captain Kelly and they had discussed the failed importation by the boat in Dublin Port. So they made up their minds very, very quickly. Now, if you allow for the fact that the jury had to be taken away to the jury room, a chairman would have had to be appointed, they'd have had to sit down in the room, etc., for them to have come to an acquittal verdict in 50 minutes is remarkable. They were not at all impressed.
I said that was the final question, but this one is. Okay. And it's about you, only because you mentioned in passing the second arms trial. The first arms trial collapsed, and trying to figure out, I know the reason was that the judge of the trial, Andreas O'Keefe, claimed that he had been, I suppose, maligned. He'd been accused of favouritism. What exactly was the point there?
Yeah, he was accused of favouritism by one of the barristers acting for the defendants, and he took offence at that, and quite rightly too. He was president of the High Court at the time, so he therefore felt, look, his integrity had been brought into question and that it was best for him not to proceed any further. That allegation hadn't been made by a senior counsel of the bar. It's a very serious charge to have been made.
Yeah.
So the trial recommenced with a new judge in October.
Because obviously if there is such an accusation levelled, then it might become the subject of an appeal later on, and whether the judge should have removed himself from the proceedings would become an issue. And I presume Justice O'Keefe didn't want that to happen. It's a fascinating book. It's called Deception and Lies, subtitled The Hidden History of the Arms Crisis 1970. It's published by Mercier Press and its author is David Burke. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much indeed for having me, Pat.